The Guardian.
Ladies and gentlemen, according to Wikipedia, Dick Tracy is a hard-hitting, fast-shooting and supremely intelligent police detective who has matched wits with a variety of often grotesquely ugly villains. I think that's quite a good metaphor for what Dick Tavern and Tracy Brown and their colleagues have created in Sense About Science. A hard-hitting and supremely intelligent, but hopefully not fast-shooting, presser group that stands not for science per se, but for the use of reason as a public tool, for the application of logic and evidence to all political questions. In a remarkably short time, Sense About Science has not only established this lecture as a high point in the intellectual calendar of London, but has established itself as a potent force in illuminating truths about genetic modification, vaccines, homeopathy, and more recently testing and radiation. I think there are three key ingredients to Sense About Science's success. One is that it's a bottom-up organisation drawing on the help and efforts of many people in this room and elsewhere to sell the story of organised common sense. This is not an organisation you join so much as one you use. The second is to understand that they're not so much up against ignorance as misconception. As the Swedish health economist Hans Rosling said recently, chimpanzees would do better than his freshman students on a yes-no test he set them about world health statistics because chimpanzees do not have wrong misconceptions. And the third ingredient is that Sense About Science understands the need for persuasion. You have to get people's attention with stunts as well as learned articles. You have to get on the roof of the House of Commons. Or tell Newsnight to ask homeopaths what anti-malarials they would prescribe to someone going abroad. Or in my case, you go out in the middle of the night and make crop circles. Or you write an article on how gravity is a social construct and get it published in a leading journal of cultural studies. Which is, of course, what our speaker tonight so famously did in 1996. Who can forget his brilliant parody, one sentence of which reads, "It has thus become increasingly apparent that physical reality, no less than social reality, is at bottom a social and linguistic construct. That scientific knowledge, far from being objective, reflects and encodes the dominant ideologies and power relations of the culture that produced it. That the truth claims of science are inherently theory-laden and self-referential. And consequently, that the discourse of the scientific community, for all its undeniable value, cannot assert a privileged epistemological status with respect to counter-hegemonic narratives emanating from dissident or marginalised communities." Quite glad I got through that, Alan. That paper, of course, changed Alan Sokol's life. As he himself puts it, "I honestly had no idea how big a hoopla my little experiment would stir up. I had expected it to be a significant but modest scandal within a small academic community, meriting a mention on page 10 of the Chronicle of Higher Education. It didn't even cross my mind that the story would make the front page of the New York Times, followed by the International Herald Tribune, The Observer, and 7 months later, after the French realised that their own celebrated public intellectuals were a primary target, Le Monde." Alan Sokol, as you know, divides his time between teaching mathematics at University College London and teaching physics at New York University. And his new book, Beyond the Hoax, is published today and is available, or this month anyway, and is available today. And his lecture is entitled, "What is Science and Why Should We Care?" Ladies and gentlemen, Alan Sokol.
Thank you for all the kind words. I'm getting old. I have to use these reading glasses. So I'd like to thank Dick Tracy and everyone at Sense About Science for inviting me to give this third annual lecture. But they've given me a very hard act to follow. 2 years ago, Sir John Krebs provided a superb overview of the messiness of translating science into public policy. And then last year, Raymond Tallis gave not only a masterful summary of the achievements of scientific medicine in enhancing human life, but also an astute analysis of the psychological attractions of junk science. Now, my own scientific expertise is in statistical mechanics and quantum field theory. areas of physics that I don't imagine are likely to have urgent public policy implications anytime soon. So I will have to speak tonight about a more general theme, namely the nature of scientific inquiry and its importance for public life. At a superficial level, you could say that my topic is the relation between science and society, but as I hope will become clear, my deeper theme is the importance not so much of science, but of the scientific worldview, a concept that goes far beyond the specific disciplines that we usually think of as science, in humanity's collective decision-making. I want to argue that clear thinking, combined with a respect for evidence, especially inconvenient and unwanted evidence, evidence that challenges our preconceptions, are of the utmost importance to the survival of the human race in the 21st century. Now, of course, you might think that calling for clear thinking and a respect for evidence is a bit like advocating motherhood and apple pie, if you'll pardon me this Americanism. And in a sense, you'd be right. Hardly anyone will openly defend muddled thinking or disrespect for evidence. Rather, what people do is to surround these practices with a fog of verbiage designed to conceal from their listeners, and in most cases, I would imagine, from themselves as well, the true implications of their reasoning. George Orwell got it right when he observed that the main advantage of speaking and writing clearly is that when you make a stupid remark, its stupidity will be obvious even to yourself. So I hope that I'll be as clear tonight as Orwell would have wished, and I intend to illustrate disrespect for evidence with a variety of examples coming from the left and the right and the center, starting from some fairly lightweight targets and proceeding to heavier ones. I aim to show that the implications of taking seriously an evidence-based worldview are rather more radical than many people realize. So let me start, perhaps a bit pedantically, by drawing some important distinctions. The word science, as commonly used, has at least four distinct meanings. It denotes, first of all, an intellectual endeavor aimed at a rational understanding of the natural and social world. It denotes a corpus of currently accepted substantive knowledge. It denotes the community of scientists with its mores and its social and economic structure. And finally, it denotes applied science and technology. In this talk, I'll be concentrating on the first two aspects, along with some secondary references to the sociology of the scientific community, and I won't address technology at all. So by science, I mean, first of all, a worldview giving primacy to reason and observation, and a methodology aimed at acquiring accurate knowledge of the natural and social world. This methodology is characterized above all else by the critical spirit, namely the commitment to the incessant testing of assertions through observations and/or experiments. The more stringent the tests, the better, and to revising or discarding those theories that fail the test. One corollary of the critical spirit is fallibilism, namely, the understanding that all our empirical knowledge is tentative, incomplete, and open to revision in the light of new evidence or cogent new arguments, though, of course, the most well-established scientific aspects of scientific knowledge are unlikely to be discarded entirely. It's important to note that well-tested theories in the mature sciences are supported in general by a powerful web of interlocking evidence coming from a variety of sources. Rarely does everything rest on one crucial experiment. Moreover, the progress of science tends to link these theories into a unified framework so that, for instance, biology has to be compatible with chemistry and chemistry with physics. The philosopher Susan Hack has illuminatingly analogized science to the problem of completing a crossword puzzle, in which any modification of one word will entail changes in interlocking words. In most cases, the required changes will be fairly local, but in some cases, it may be necessary to rework large parts of the puzzle. I stress that my use of the term science is not limited to the natural sciences, but includes investigations aimed at acquiring accurate knowledge of factual matters relating to any aspect of the world by using rational empirical methods analogous to those employed in the natural sciences. And please note the limitation to questions of fact. I'm intentionally excluding from my purview questions of ethics, aesthetics, ultimate purpose, and so forth. So science, as I use the term, is routinely practiced not only by physicists, chemists, and biologists, but also by historians, detectives, plumbers, and indeed all human beings in some aspects of our daily lives. Of course, the fact that we all practice science from time to time does not mean that we all practice it equally well, or that we practice it equally well in all areas of our lives. Now, the extraordinary successes of the natural sciences over the last 400 years in learning about the world, from quarks to quasars and everything in between, are well known to every modern citizen. Science is a fallible, yet enormously successful method for obtaining objective, albeit approximate and incomplete, knowledge of the natural and, to a lesser extent, the social world. But surprisingly, not everyone accepts this. And here I come to my first and most lightweight example of adversaries of the scientific worldview, namely academic postmodernists and extreme social constructivists. Such people insist that so-called scientific knowledge does not, in fact, constitute objective knowledge of a reality external to ourselves, but is a mere social construction, on a par with myths and religions, which therefore have an equal claim to validity. Now, if such a view seems so implausible that you wonder whether I'm somehow exaggerating, consider the following assertions by prominent sociologists. The validity of theoretical propositions in the sciences is in no way affected by factual evidence. Kenneth Gergen. The natural world has a small or non-existent role in the construction of scientific knowledge. Harry Collins. For the relativists, such as ourselves, there is no sense attached to the idea that some standards or beliefs are really rational as distinct from merely locally accepted as such. Barry Barnes and David Bloor. Now, many more similar quotes could be given, but let me not spend time beating a dead horse, as the arguments against postmodernist relativism are by now fairly well known. Rather than plugging my own writings, let me suggest instead the superb book by the Canadian philosopher of science, James Robert Brown, Who Rules in Science? An Opinionated Guide to the Wars. Suffice it to say that postmodernist writings systematically confuse truth with claims of truth, fact with assertions of fact, and knowledge with pretensions to knowledge, and then sometimes go so far as to deny that these distinctions have any meaning. Now, it's worth noting that the postmodernist writings I've just quoted all come from the 1980s and early 1990s. In fact, over the past decade, academic postmodernists and social constructivists seem to have backed off the most extreme views that they previously espoused. Perhaps I and like-minded critics of postmodernism can take some small credit for this by initiating a public debate that shed a harsh light of criticism on these views and forced some strategic retreats. But most of the credit, I think, has to be awarded to George W. Bush and his friends, who have shown just where science bashing can lead in the real world. Nowadays, even sociologist of science Bruno Latour, who spent several decades stressing the so-called social construction of scientific facts, now laments the ammunition he fears he and his colleagues have given to the Republican right wing, helping them to deny or obscure the scientific consensus on global warming, biological evolution, and a host of other issues. That's exactly the danger I was trying to warn about back in 1996. I hate to say I told you so, but I did. As did several years before me, Noam Chomsky, who recalled that in a not-so-distant past, left intellectuals took an active part in the lively working-class culture. Some sought to compensate for the class character of the cultural institutions through programs of workers' education or by writing best-selling books on mathematics, science, and other topics for the general public. Remarkably, their left counterparts today often seek to deprive working people of these tools of emancipation, informing us that the project of the Enlightenment is dead, that we must abandon the illusions of science and rationality. A message that will gladden the hearts of the powerful, delighted to monopolize these instruments for their own use. That was Noam Chomsky back in 1993. Okay, let me now pass to a second set of adversaries of the scientific worldview, namely the advocates of pseudoscience. Now, this is, of course, an enormous area, so let me focus on one socially important aspect of it, namely so-called complementary and alternative therapies in health and medicine. It was recently reported that the UK government will be introducing standards of competence in homeopathy, aromatherapy, reflexology, and other alternative therapies in order to protect the public from inadequately trained practitioners. Now, that sounds nice at first glance. But what precisely does it mean to be competent in a system of pseudo-medicine that has never been demonstrated to be efficacious beyond the placebo effect? Perhaps for its next act, the NHS will introduce bloodletting and trepanation, duly guaranteed by rigorous standards of competence for practitioners. Now, it's worth looking in a bit of detail at one of the most widely used alternative therapies, namely homeopathy, because its advocates sometimes claim that there is evidence from meta-analyses of clinical trials that homeopathy works. Now, one basic principle in all of science is GIGO, garbage in, garbage out. This principle is particularly important in statistical meta-analysis because if you have a bunch of methodologically poor studies, each with small sample size, and then subject them to meta-analysis, what can happen is that the systematic biases in each study, if they mostly point in the same direction, can reach statistical significance when the studies are pooled. And this possibility is particularly relevant here because meta-analyses of homeopathy invariably find an inverse correlation between the methodological quality of the study and the observed effectiveness of homeopathy. That is, the sloppiest studies find the strongest evidence in favor of homeopathy. When one restricts attention only to methodologically sound studies, those that include adequate randomization and double blinding, predefined outcome measures, and clear accounting for dropouts, the meta-analyses find no statistically significant effect, whether positive or negative, of homeopathy compared to placebo. But the lack of convincing statistical evidence for the efficacy of homeopathy is not, in fact, the main reason why I and other scientists are skeptical, to put it mildly, about homeopathy, and it's worth taking a few moments to explain this main reason. Most people, perhaps even most users of homeopathic remedies, do not clearly understand what homeopathy is. They probably think of it as a species of herbal medicine. Of course, plants contain a wide variety of substances, some of which can be biologically active, with either beneficial or harmful consequences, as Socrates learned. But homeopathic remedies, by contrast, are pure water and starch. The alleged active ingredient is so highly diluted that in most cases not a single molecule remains in the final product. And so the fundamental reason for rejecting homeopathy is that there is no plausible mechanism by which homeopathy could possibly work unless one rejects everything that we have learned over the last 200 years about physics and chemistry, namely that matter is made of atoms and that the properties of matter, including its chemical and biological effects, depend on its atomic structure. There's simply no way that an absent ingredient could have a therapeutic effect. High-quality clinical trials find no difference between homeopathy and placebo because homeopathic remedies are placebos. Now, advocates of homeopathy sometimes respond to this argument by asserting that the curative effect of homeopathic remedies arises from a memory of the vanished active ingredient that is somehow retained by the water in which it was dissolved and then by the starch when the water is evaporated. But the difficulty, once again, is not simply the lack of any reliable experimental evidence for such a memory of water. Rather, the problem is that the existence of such a phenomenon would contradict well-tested science, in this case, the statistical mechanics of fluids. The molecules of any liquid are constantly being bumped by other molecules, what physicists call thermal fluctuations, so that they quickly lose any memory of their past configuration. And when I say quickly, I'm talking picoseconds, not months. So in short, all the millions of experiments confirming modern physics and chemistry also constitute powerful evidence against homeopathy. For this reason, the flaw in the justification of homeopathy is not merely the lack of statistical evidence showing the efficacy of homeopathic remedies over placebo at the 95 or 99% confidence level. Even an experiment at the 99.9% confidence level would not begin to compete with all the evidence in favor of modern physics and chemistry. Extraordinary claims require extraordinary evidence. And I should say, in the unlikely event that such convincing evidence is ever forthcoming, the person who provides it will assuredly win a triple Nobel Prize in physics, chemistry, and biology, beating out Marie Curie, who won only two. Now, despite the utter scientific implausibility of homeopathy, the NHS actively promotes homeopathy on its website and provides homeopathic treatment at the taxpayer's expense. There are five homeopathic hospitals in the UK, four of which are funded by NHS money. It was five until a few months ago. Alas, no one, not even the health minister, seems to know how much the NHS spends annually on unproven or disproven complementary and alternative therapies because the NHS does not bother to keep track. But estimates range from £50 million to £450 million annually. Probably closer to the smaller number is more accurate. Now, granted, that's a tiny fraction of the £92 billion NHS budget, but still, it's money that could give thousands of cancer patients provably effective therapies that are now denied for cost reasons. Okay, let me now discuss a third and yet more dangerous set of adversaries of the evidence-based worldview, namely the advocates of religion. When analyzing religion, I think a few distinctions are perhaps in order. For starters, religious doctrines typically have two components: a factual part, consisting of a set of claims about the universe and its history, and an ethical part, consisting of a set of prescriptions about how to live. In addition, all religions make, at least implicitly, epistemological claims concerning the methods by which humans can obtain reasonably reliable knowledge of factual or ethical matters. These three aspects of each religion obviously need to be evaluated separately. Also, when discussing any set of ideas, it's important to distinguish between the intrinsic merit of those ideas, the objective role they play in the world, and the subjective reasons for which various people defend or attack them. Alas, much discussion of religion fails to make these elementary distinctions. For instance, confusing the intrinsic merit of an idea with the good or bad effects that it may have in the world. Now, tonight I want to address only the most fundamental issue, namely the intrinsic merit of the various religions' factual doctrines. And within that, I want to focus on the epistemological question, or to put it in less fancy language, the relationship between belief and evidence. After all, those who believe in their religion's factual doctrines presumably do so for what they consider to be good reasons. So it's sensible to ask, what are these alleged good reasons? Each religion makes scores of purportedly factual assertions about everything from the creation of the universe to the afterlife. But on what grounds can believers presume to know that these assertions are true? The reasons they give are various, but they ultimately boil down to one: because our holy scriptures say so. But how then do we know that our holy scriptures are free from error? Because the scriptures themselves say so. Now, theologians specialize in weaving elaborate webs of verbiage to avoid saying anything quite so bluntly. But this gem of circular reasoning really is the epistemological bottom line on which all faith is grounded. In the words of Pope John Paul II, quote, "By the authority of his absolute transcendence, God who makes himself known is also the source of the credibility of what he reveals." It goes without saying that this begs the question of whether the texts at issue really were authored or inspired by God, and on what grounds one knows this. Faith is not, in fact, a rejection of reason, but simply a lazy acceptance of bad reasons. Faith is the pseudo-justification that some people trot out when they want to make claims without the necessary evidence. Let me give another paradigmatic example of theological obfuscation, this time from the professor of historical theology at Oxford University, Anglican theologian Alistair McGrath. McGrath defines faith as follows. Faith affects the whole of man's nature. It commences with the conviction of the mind based on adequate evidence. It continues in the confidence of the heart or emotions based on conviction, and it is crowned in the consent of the will by means of which the conviction and confidence are expressed in conduct. As Michael Shermer accurately observes in his review of McGrath's book, nearly all of this definition describes the psychology of belief. The only clause of relevance to a scientist, or I would add to an epistemologist, is adequate evidence, which raises the follow-up question, is there? Alas, McGrath does not bother to address this perfectly obvious question anywhere in his 200-page book. Worse yet, McGrath wants to have his cake and eat it too. When it suits his argumentative purposes, he reverts to the everyday meaning of the word faith, flatly contradicting his own definition. He says, "It is increasingly recognized that philosophical argument about the existence of God has ground to a halt. The matter lies beyond rational proof and is ultimately a matter of faith in the sense of judgments made in the absence of sufficient evidence." By the way, I never did get a straight answer when I asked some Oxford colleagues why Oxford has a faculty of theology but no faculty of astrology. Now, the American commentator David Morris has recently made the useful suggestion that the word religion, or its currently fashionable ecumenical-sounding euphemism, faith, be replaced by the epistemologically more illuminating term, superstition. For instance, President Bush could extol religion as follows. "I believe in the power of superstition in people's lives. Our government should not fear programs that exist because a church or a synagogue or a mosque has decided to start one. We should not discriminate against programs based on superstition in America. We should enable them to access federal money because superstition-based programs can change people's lives and America will be better off for it." And then he could also go on to stress that the superstition-based initiative is not about a single superstition. In this country, we're great because we've got many superstitions. And we're great because you can choose whatever superstition you choose. Or if you choose no superstition at all, you're still equally American. The clarity of our national discourse would be notably improved by this simple rephrasing. This clarification would also be salutary here in Britain, where former Prime Minister Tony Blair assiduously promoted government subsidies for so-called faith-based schools. After it was reported that a publicly funded Christian school in Gateshead had been teaching creationism, Blair was asked in Parliament whether he was happy to allow the teaching of creationism alongside Darwin's theory of evolution in state schools. Blair, always the consummate politician, avoided a direct answer, but defended the school in question and said that, quote, "In the end, a more diverse school system will deliver better results for our children," unquote. So shall we also, in the name of diversity, subsidize schools teaching that the moon is made of green cheese? Now, of course, Muslim, Hindu, Sikh, and Jewish Britons can rightly complain that the state has long funded Church of England and Roman Catholic schools. But the proper remedy is not to extend state patronage from Christianity to other superstitions. Rather, it is to implement a complete separation of church from state, and more generally, to insist that taxpayer-funded institutions have no business propagating dogmas unsupported by evidence. Moreover, segregating children of Muslim parents from children of Christian parents for separate indoctrination is woefully misguided. Instead, why not bring together students of both backgrounds in a high school history class to examine the historical evidence bearing on the composition of the New Testament and the Quran. Now, in all these examples, I've been at pains to distinguish clearly between factual matters and ethical or aesthetic matters, because the epistemological issues they raise are so different. And I've restricted my discussion almost entirely to factual matters, simply because of the limitations of my own competence. But if I'm preoccupied by the relation between belief and evidence, it's not solely for intellectual reasons, not solely because I, like my friend Norm Levitt, am, quote, a grumpy old fart who aspires to the sullen joy of having it known that I don't suffer fools gladly. Rather, my concern that public debate be grounded in the best available evidence is, above all else, ethical. Now, to illustrate the connection I have in mind between epistemology and ethics, let me start with a fanciful example. Suppose that the leader of a militarily powerful country believes, sincerely but erroneously, on the basis of flawed intelligence, that a smaller country possesses threatening weapons of mass destruction. And suppose further that he launches a preemptive war on that basis, killing tens of thousands of innocent civilians as collateral damage. Aren't he and his supporters ethically culpable for their epistemic sloppiness? Now, I stress that this example is fanciful. All the available evidence suggests that the Bush and Blair administrations first decided to overthrow Saddam Hussein and then sought a publicly presentable pretext using dubious or even forged intelligence to justify that pretext and to mislead Congress, Parliament, and the public into supporting that war. Which brings me to the last and, in my opinion, most dangerous set of adversaries of the evidence-based worldview in the contemporary world, namely propagandists, public relations flacks, and spin doctors, along with the politicians and corporations who employ them. In short, all those whose goal is not to analyze honestly the evidence for and against a particular policy, but is simply to manipulate the public into reaching a predetermined conclusion by whatever technique will work, however dishonest or fraudulent. So the issue here is no longer mere muddled thinking or sloppy reasoning, it's fraud. Now, I'm aware that the English libel laws are rather stringent. So just to avoid any misunderstanding about whether I'm accusing George Bush and Tony Blair of fraud, let me be clear. I am. I'm relying here on the fact that even in England, truth is an absolute defense against a charge of libel. Now, the Oxford English Dictionary defines fraud as, quote, the using of false representations to obtain an unjust advantage or to injure the rights or interests of another. Black's Law Dictionary defines fraud rather more ornately as all the multifarious means which human ingenuity can devise, which are resorted to by one individual to get an advantage over another by false suggestions or suppression of the truth. It includes all surprise, trick, cunning, dissembling, and any unfair way by which another is cheated. In the Anglo-American common law, a false representation can take many forms, including a false statement of fact known to be false at the time it was made, a statement of fact with no reasonable basis to make that statement, a promise of future performance made with an intent at the time the promise was made not to perform as promised, an expression of opinion that is false made by one claiming or implying to have special knowledge of the subject matter of the opinion, where special knowledge means knowledge or information superior to that possessed by the other party and to which the other party did not have equal access. Anything here sound familiar? These are the standards that we would use if George Bush and Tony Blair had sold us a used car. In fact, they sold us a war that has thus far cost the lives of 174 British soldiers, 3,963 American soldiers, and somewhere between 80,000 and 1 million Iraqis. It's a scandal that I can't tell you more accurately how many Iraqi dead there are. That is a human toll that's somewhere between 25 and 300 September 11th. A war that has thus far cost the American taxpayers a staggering $498 billion, with ultimate estimates ranging from $1 to $2 trillion, and that has strengthened both al-Qaeda and Iran. In short, a war that may well turn out to be the greatest foreign policy blunder of American history. You British have a longer history. And hence, a longer history of blunders to compete with. Now, all this is very likely old hat to most of you in this room. We know perfectly well that our politicians, or at least some of them, lie to us. We take it for granted. We are inured to it. And that may be precisely the problem. Perhaps we have become so inured to political lies, so hard-headedly cynical, that we have lost our ability to become appropriately outraged. We've lost our ability to call a spade, a lie, a fraud. Instead, we call it spin. We've now traveled a long way from science, if you understand it narrowly as physics, chemistry, biology, and the like. But the whole point is that any such narrow definition of science is misguided. We live in a single real world. The administrative divisions used for convenience in our universities do not, in fact, correspond to any natural philosophical boundaries. You can't use one set of standards of evidence in physics, chemistry, and biology, and then suddenly relax your standards when it comes to medicine, religion, or politics. Or rather, you can do so, as all too many people do, but you have no justification for doing so. Now, lest this sound to you like a scientist's imperialism, I want to stress that it's exactly the contrary. As the philosopher Susan Hack lucidly observes, our standards of what constitutes good, honest, thorough inquiry and what constitutes good, strong, supportive evidence are not internal to science. In judging where science has succeeded and where it has failed, in what areas and at what times it has done better and in what worse, we are appealing to the standards by which we judge the solidity of empirical beliefs or the rigor and thoroughness of empirical inquiry generally. The bottom line is that science is not merely a bag of clever tricks that turn out to be useful in investigating some arcane questions about the inanimate and biological worlds. Rather, the natural sciences are nothing more or less than one particular application, albeit an unusually successful one, of a more general rationalist worldview centered on the modest insistence that empirical claims must be substantiated by empirical evidence. Conversely, the philosophical lessons learned from four centuries of work in the natural sciences can be of real value, if properly understood, in other domains of human life. Now, of course, I'm not suggesting that historians or policymakers should use exactly the same methods as physicists. That would be absurd. But neither do biologists use precisely the same methods as physicists. Nor, for that matter, do biochemists use the same methods as ecologists, or solid-state physicists as elementary particle physicists. The detailed methods of inquiry must, of course, be adapted to the subject matter at hand. What remains unchanged in all areas of life, however, is the underlying philosophy, namely, to constrain our theories as strongly as possible by empirical evidence, and to modify or reject those theories that fail to conform to the evidence. That is what I mean by the scientific worldview. It's because of this general philosophical lesson, far more than any specific discoveries, that the natural sciences have had such a profound effect on human culture since the time of Galileo and Francis Bacon. The affirmative side of science, consisting of its well-verified claims about the physical and biological world, may be what first springs to mind when people think about science. But it's actually the critical and skeptical side of science that is the most profound and the most intellectually subversive. The scientific worldview inevitably comes into conflict with all non-scientific modes of thought that make purportedly factual claims about the world. And how could it be otherwise? After all, scientists are constantly subjecting their colleagues' theories to severe conceptual and empirical scrutiny. On what grounds could one reject phlogistic chemistry, the inheritance of acquired characteristics, or Newton's particle theory of light, and yet accept astrology, homeopathy, or the virgin birth? The first group of theories is no worse than the second, in fact, is much less bad. Now, the critical thrust of science even extends beyond the factual realm that I have, for the most part, restricted myself to ethics and politics. Now, of course, as a logical matter, one cannot derive an ought from an is. But historically, starting in the 17th and 18th centuries in Europe, and then spreading gradually to more or less the entire world, scientific skepticism has played the role of an intellectual acid, slowly dissolving the irrational beliefs that legitimated the established social order and its supposed authorities, be they the priesthood, the monarchy, the aristocracy, or allegedly superior races and social classes. 400 years later, it seems sadly evident, as I've tried to demonstrate tonight, that this revolutionary transition from a dogmatic to an evidence-based worldview is very far from being complete. Thank you.
For more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.